With all her strength, Kaylin rammed her knee into his groin. Gotti doubled over, unable to draw his breath. His eyes rolled up in his head and he went down hard. Kara smiled.
I thought you might like to hear that part.
Kaylin wiped the tears from her cheeks.
It wasn't Richard. I knew it wasn't Richard. It was this pig.
Kaylin kicked him in the ribs as he started coming around. He let out a cry. She wagged her fingers impatiently. Kara seized him by the hair and yanked him to his feet.
Finish your story,
Kaylin said with icy rage. He coughed and gagged and drooled. Kara had to steady him on his feet. She held his arms behind his back so he couldn't comfort his groin. The pain was clearly evident in his contorted face.
Talk, or I'll do it again.
Please, I was telling you when you stopped me.
Get on with it, he nodded frantically.
When I was done with the whore, when I left, Nikki, Camille, and Nobby were crazy.
Kaylin lifted his chin.
What do you mean they were crazy?
They were crazy angry because I was with Richard's wife. They like Richard, so they were crazy angry with me. They were going to do things to me, hurt me. So I decided to go into the army to fight for the order against the heathens and...
Kaylin waited. She glanced up at Kara. The moored Sith did something behind Gotti's back that made him gasp in a cry.
And then I turned in Richard's name.
You did what?
I turned in his name before I left. I told the city guards at Protector Muxin's office that Richard was doing criminal things, that he was stealing work from working people, that he was making more than his fair share.
Kaylin frowned.
What does that mean? What happens when you turn in a name?
Gotti was trembling in terror. He clearly didn't want to answer. Kara pressed her agile against his side. Blood oozed down his sweat-soaked shirt. He tried, but couldn't draw breath. His ashen face began to turn purple.
Tell her, Kara said in cold command.
Gotti gasped in a breath when she released the pressure.
They will arrest him. They will make him confess.
Confess? Kaylin asked, fearing the answer. Gotti nodded reluctantly.
They will torture a confession out of him, most likely. They might even hang his body from a pole and let the birds pick his bones, if he confesses to something bad.
Kaylin swayed on her feet. She thought she might throw up.
The world had disintegrated into madness.
She kicked over the map basket and pawed through the maps until she found the one she wanted. She pulled a pen and ink bottle out of their box, set the statue of Spirit on the ground, and spread the small map across the table.
Come here, Kaylin ordered, snapping her fingers and pointing to the ground before the table.
She put the pen in his trembling fingers after he had shuffled close. Kaylin pointed at the map.
We are here. Show me where you traveled with the Order.
He pointed.
This river. I came up from the Old World with the reinforcement troops after some training. We joined the Emperor's force, and we advanced up this river basin over the summer.
Kaylin pointed to the Old World.
Now, I want you to mark the place where you lived.
Al-Turang, that's it, there.
She watched him dip the pen and circle the dot and the name Al-Turang far to the south, the heart of the Old World.
Now, she said, mark the roads you came up in the Old World, including any cities or towns you went through.
Kara and Kaylin both watched Gotti mark roads and circle the number of cities and towns. Warren and the sisters were from the Old World. They knew a great deal about the lay of the land, enabling them to provide detailed maps. When he'd finished, Gotti looked up.
Kaylin turned over the map. Draw the city of Al-Turang. I want to see the major roads. Anything you know of it.
Gotti immediately set to drawing the map for her. When he was finished, he looked up again.
Now,
"Show me where this room is where Richard lives."
Gotti marked the map to indicate the place.
"But I don't know if he will be there. Lots of people turn in the names of people suspected of wrongdoing against their fellow man. If they take the name and they arrest him, the brothers may order penance, or they could even question him and then order him put to death."
"Brothers?" Kalin asked.
Gotti nodded. "Brother Narev and his disciples. They are the head of the Fellowship of Order. Brother Narev is our spiritual guide. He and the brothers are the heart of the order."
"What do they look like?" Kalin asked, her mind already racing ahead.
"The brothers wear dark brown robes with hoods. They are simple men who have given up the luxuries of life to serve the wishes of the Creator and the needs of mankind. Brother Narev is closer to the Creator than any man alive. He is mankind's savior."
Gotti was clearly awed by the man. Kalin listened while Gotti told her everything he knew about the Fellowship of Order, about the brothers, and about Brother Narev. Gotti shook in the silence after he had finished. Kalin wasn't watching him, but staring off.
"What did Richard look like?" she asked in a distant voice. "Was he well? Did he look all right?"
"Yes. He's big and strong. Foolish people like him."
Kalin spun around, landing the heel of her hand against Gotti's face, hard enough to knock him from his feet.
"Get him out of here," she told Kara.
"But you must show me mercy now. I told you what you want to know," he broke down in tears. "You must show me mercy."
"You have a job to finish," Kalin said to Kara.
Kalin pulled the tent flap back and peeked in. Sister Dulcinea was snoring softly. Holly looked up. Tears filled the girl's eyes as she stretched out her arms pleadingly. Kalin knelt beside the girl and bent over to hug her. Holly started crying. Sister Dulcinea woke with a snort.
"Mother Confessor!"
Kalin put a hand on the sister's arm. "It's late. Why don't you go get some sleep, sister?" Sister Dulcinea smiled her agreement and then grunted with the effort of struggling to her feet in the low tent. In the distance, on the far side of the camp, Kalin could hear Gotti's blood-curdling screams. Kalin smoothed the downy hair from Holly's brow and kissed her there.
"How are you, sweetheart? Are you all right?"
"Oh, Mother Confessor, it was awful. Wizard Warren got hurt. I saw it."
Kalin hugged her as she started weeping again.
"I know. I know."
"Is it all right? Is he healed like they healed me?"
Kalin cupped the little cheek and wiped a tear away with her thumb.
"I'm sorry, Holly, but Warren died."
Her brow bunched up with her misery.
"He shouldn't have tried to save me. It's my fault he's dead."
"No," Kalin soothed. "That's not the way it is. Warren gave his life to save us all. He did what he did out of his love of life. He didn't want to let evil be free among those he loved."
"Do you really think so?"
"Of course I do. Remember him for how he loved life and how he wanted to see those he loved free to live their own lives.
He danced with me at his wedding. I thought he was the most handsome groom ever."
"He was indeed a handsome groom," Kalin said with a smile at the memory.
"He was one of the best men I've ever known, and he gave his life to help keep us free. We honor his sacrifice by living the best lives we can live."
Kalin started to rise, but Holly hugged her all the tighter, so Kalin laid down beside her. She stroked Holly's brow and kissed her cheek.
"Will you stay with me, Mother Confessor? Please?
For a while, sweetheart."
Holly fell asleep, cuddled up to Kalin. Kalin wept frustrated, bitter tears over the sleeping girl. A girl who should have the right to live her life. Others, though, lusted to steal that right at the point of a blade.
After she had finally decided what she must do, Kaylin slipped silently out of the tent to go pack her things. It was just turning light when Kaylin emerged from her tent, carrying her bedroll, saddlebags, Daharan's sword, the sword of truth, leather armor, and packed with the rest of her things. Spirit was safely rolled up in her bedroll. A light snow was just beginning to fall, announcing to the muted camp that winter had arrived in the northern Midlands. Everything seemed as if it was ending. It wasn't just Warren's death that convinced her, but rather the futility it symbolized. She could no longer delude herself. The truth was the truth. Richard was right. The Order would have it all. Sooner or later they would have her and kill her, along with those who fought with her. It was only a matter of time until they enslaved all of the New World. They already had much of the Midlands. Some lands had fallen willingly. There was no way to resist a force of their overwhelming size, the terror of their threats, or the seduction of their promises. Warren had attested it as part of his dying words. Richard was right. She had thought she could make a difference. She had thought she could drive back the advancing horde by the sheer weight of her will, if need be. It was arrogance on her part. The forces of freedom were lost. Many of the people in those fallen lands had put their faith in the Order at the cost of their liberty. What was left to her? Running? Retreat? Terror? Death? She had nothing to lose anymore, really. Nearly everything was already lost, or soon would be. While she at least still had her life, she was going to use it. She was going to go to the heart of the Order. "What are you doing?" Kaylin spun around to see Kara frowning at her. "Kara, I'm leaving." Kara gave a single nod. "Good. I too think it is time. I won't be long getting my things together. You get the horses and I'll meet—" "No, I'm going alone. You will stay here." Kara stroked her long blonde braid, laying over the front of her shoulder. "Why are you going?" "There's nothing left here for me to do. Nothing I can do. I'm going to go drive my sword into the heart of the Order, Brother Narev and his disciples. It's the only thing I can do to strike back at them." Kara smiled. "And you think I want to stay here?" "You will stay here, where you should be, with Benjamin." "I'm sorry, Mother Confessor," Kara said tenderly, "but I can't follow such orders. I am Mord Sith. My life is sworn to protecting Lord Rahl. I promised Lord Rahl I would protect you, not stay and kiss Benjamin. Kara, I want you to stay here. It's my life. If this is the end, all there is to be, then I will do with the rest of my life as I wish. It's my life to live, not yours to live for me. I'm going, and that is final." Kaylin saw in Kara's eyes that it was. Kaylin didn't think she had ever heard Kara express such a sentiment about her own wishes. It was indeed her life. Besides, Kara knew where Kaylin was going. If Kaylin left without Kara, Kara would simply follow. Getting Mord Sith to obey orders was often more difficult than herding ants. "You're right, Kara. It is your life. But when we get down into the old world, you're going to have to wear something to disguise who you are. Red leather in the old world will be the end of us. I will do what I must to protect you and Lord Rahl." Kaylin smiled at last. "I believe you would, Kara." Kara wasn't smiling. Kaylin's smile faded. "I'm sorry I tried to leave without you, Kara. I shouldn't have done it that way. You're a sister of the Ajeel. I should have talked it over with you. That's the proper way to treat someone you respect." Kara smiled at last. "Now you are making sense." "We might not ever come back from this." Kara shrugged.
And you think we will live the high life if we stay? I think only certain death awaits us if we stay.
Kaelin nodded. That's what I think, too. That's why I must go.
I'm not quarreling.
Kaelin gazed out at the falling snow. The last time winter had come, she and Kara had just managed to escape in time.
Kaelin steeled herself and asked, Kara, do you really believe Richard is still alive?
Of course Lord Rahl is alive.
Kara held up her Ajeel, rolling it in her fingers.
Remember?
And then she did. The Ajeel would only work if the Lord Rahl, to whom she was sworn, was alive.
Kaelin handed Kara some of her load.
Gadi?
He died as Verna wished it.
She showed him no pity.
Good. Pity for the guilty is treason to the innocent.
It was not long after dawn when Kaelin made it to Zed's tent. Kara had gone to get horses and supplies. When Kaelin called, Zed asked her to enter. He rose from the bench beside Adi, the old sorceress.
Kaelin! What is it?
I have come to bid you goodbye.
Zed's eyes showed no surprise.
Why don't you stay and get some rest? Leave tomorrow.
There are no tomorrows left. Winter is upon us again. If I am going to do as I must, I don't have a day to waste.
Zed gently gripped her shoulders.
Kaelin, Warren wanted to see you. He felt he had to tell you that Richard was right. It meant a great deal to him that you know that. Richard told us that you must not attack the heart of the Order before the people prove themselves to him, or all will be lost. Such a thing is even less likely to happen today than the day he said it.
And maybe Warren meant that Richard was right, that we are going to lose the new world to the Order, and so what is there to stay for? Maybe it was Warren's way of trying to tell me to go to Richard before I'm dead, or he's dead, and then it's too late to even try.
And Nikki?
I'll find out when I get there.
But you can't hope to...
Zed, what else is there for me? To watch the Midlands fall? To aspire at most to live out my life running? To live as a recluse, hiding every day from the clutches of the Order? Even if Warren hadn't said it, I've come to realize, no matter how much I wish it was otherwise, that Richard is right. The Order will only be pinned down for the winter while we help the people escape Adendril. In the spring, the enemy will flood into my city. Then they will turn to Dahara. There will be nowhere to run. Though they escape for the moment, the Order will subjugate those people. There is no future for me. Richard was right. The least I can do is spend the last of my life living for myself and for Richard. There is nothing else left for me, Zed.
Tears brimmed in his eyes.
I will miss you so. You've brought back good memories of my own daughter, and given me so many good times.
Kaelin threw her arms around him.
Oh, Zed, I love you.
She couldn't hold back her own tears then. She was all he had left, and he was losing her, too.
No, that wasn't true.
Kaelin pulled back. Zed, the time has come for you to leave, too. You must go to the keep and protect it. He nodded with great reluctance, great sadness.
I know.
Kaelin knelt before the sorceress and took up her hand.
Adi, will you go with him and keep him company?
A beautiful smile came to the woman's weathered face.
Well, I... She looked up. Zed?
Zed scowled.
Bags! Now you've ruined the surprise of the invite.
Kaelin smacked his leg.
Stop cursing in front of ladies, and stop being so sour. I'd like to know you're not going to be lonely up there.
A smile stole across his face.
Of course Addie is going to the keep with me.
Addie scowled in turn.
"How do you know that, old man? You never asked my approval. Why, I have a mind—"
"Please stop it," Kaylin said. "Both of you. This is too important to be fussing over."
"I can fuss if I want to," Zed protested.
"That be right," Addie shook a thin finger. "We are old enough to fuss if we wish."
Kaylin smiled through her tears. "Of course you can. It's just that, after Warren, it reminds me of how much I hate to see people waste their lives on things that don't matter." Zed truly did scowl now.
"You've a thing or two to learn, dear one, if you don't know how important fussing is."
"That be right," Addie said. "Fussing keeps you sharp. When you get old, you need to stay sharp."
"Addie is entirely right," Zed said. "Why, I think—"
Kaylin silenced him with a hug that Addie joined.
"Are you sure about this, dear one?"
Zed asked after they parted.
"I am. I'm going to take my sword into the belly of the Order."
Zed nodded as he hooked his bony fingers around the back of her neck. He pulled her head close and kissed her brow.
"If you're to go, then ride hard and strike harder."
"I thought exactly,"
Kara said as she stepped into the tent. Kaylin thought Kara's blue eyes looked a little more liquid than usual.
"Are you all right, Kara?"
Kara frowned.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"Nothing," Kaylin said.
"General Myford got us the 6 fastest horses he could find."
Kara smiled her pleasure at the prospect.
"We'll have fresh mounts with us and be able to cover a lot of ground fast. I have all our supplies loaded up. If we leave now, we should be able to escape Winter's grip. We have the map so we can stay away from the routes the Order's troops use and the heaviest population centers. There are good roads and open country down there. Riding hard, I think we can make it in a few weeks, a month at most."
Zed's face contorted with concern.
"But the Order controls much of the southern Midlands. It's dangerous country now."
"I have a better way."
Kara flashed a sly smile.
"We'll go where I know the country, Dahara. We will go east from here and cross over the mountains, then go south down through Dahara, through mostly wide-open country where we can make good time, down through the Azrith Plains, to eventually join the Kern River far to the south. After the river valley clears the mountains, we will cut southeast into the heart of the Old World."
Zed nodded his approval of the plan. Kaylin curled her fingers lovingly around the old wizard's thin arm.
"When will you go to the keep?"
"Addie and I will leave in the morning. I think it best not to dally here any longer. Today we'll settle matters of the army with the officers and the sisters. I think that as soon as the people are out of Adendrill, and when the snow quickly deepens to ensure the Order won't be going anywhere until spring, then our men should begin slipping out of this place to make their way over the mountains to the safety of Dahara. It will be slow going in winter, but without having to fight as they travel, it won't be as difficult as it otherwise would be."
"That would be best," Kaylin agreed. "It will get our men out of harm's way for now."
"They won't have me to be the magic against magic for them. But they will have Verna and her sisters. They know enough by now to carry on protecting the army from magic."
"At least for a while." The words hung in the air unspoken.
"I want to go see Verna before I leave," Kaylin said. "I think it will be good for her to have other people to worry about. Then I want to see General Myford, and then we'd best start riding. We have a long way to go, and I want to be south before the snow hobbles us."
Kaylin embraced Zed fiercely one last time.
"When you see him," Zed whispered in her ear, "tell the boy I love him dearly, and I miss him something awful."
Kaylin nodded against his shoulder and told him a bold lie.
"You'll see us both again, Zed, I promise you."
Kalin stepped out in the early light of winter's first breath. Everything was dusted with snow, making it look as if the world were carved from white marble. Chapter 63. In one long, fluid motion, with his fingertips adeptly guiding the far end of the file, Richard glided the steel tool down the fold of cloth he held forever crisp in white marble. Concentrating on applying steady pressure to cut a precise, fine layer, he was lost in the work. The file held hundreds of ridges, row upon row of tiny blades of hardened steel, which did the work of cutting away and shaping the noble stone. These were blades he wielded with the same commitment with which he wielded any blade. He blindly reached back and set the file down on the wooden bench, careful to put it on the wood, and not to let it clang against other steel, lest he dull it prematurely. He exchanged the file for another, with even finer teeth, and took out the roughness left by the correction accomplished with the one before. With fingers as dusty white as those of a baker laboring with flour, Richard examined the surface of the man's arm, testing it for flaws. Until polished, the minor flaws and facets were often easier to see with the fingers than the eye. Where he found them, he used a smaller file in one hand, while his other hand followed behind, riding the swell of muscle, feeling the subtle difference in what the tool had done to the stone. He was removing only paper-thin layers of material now. It had taken him several months to arrive at this final layer. It was exhilarating to be so close to the flesh. The days had passed, one upon another, in an endless procession of work, carving death in the day down at the site and life in the night. Carving for the order was balanced by carving for himself, slavery and freedom in opposition. Whenever one of the brothers inquired about the statue, Richard was careful to hide his satisfaction with what he was creating. He did it by recalling the model he had been commanded to carve. He always bowed his head respectfully and reported his progress on his penance, assuring them that his work was on schedule and would be done on time to install in the palace plaza for the dedication. Stressing the word penance helped to direct their thoughts to that issue and away from the statue itself. The brothers were invariably much more satisfied with his weariness from his toil at his work of contrition than they were interested in yet another dreary stone carving. There were carvings everywhere. This was but one more manifestation of the irredeemable inadequacy of mankind. Just as no one man in their cosmos was important, no one work mattered. It was the sheer number of carvings which was to be the order's overpowering argument for man's impotence. The carvings were merely background props for the stage upon which the brothers moralized on sacrifice and salvation. Richard always humbly reported his nights with little food and little sleep as he worked on his penance after his carving work during the day. Selfless sacrifice being the proper cure for wickedness, the brothers went away pleased. Richard switched to a smaller file, one bent in a decreasing radius curve, and worked the muscle where it narrowed into sinew, showing the tension in the arm which revealed the underlying structure. During the day he observed other men as they worked, in order to study the complex shapes of muscle as it moved with life. At night he referred to his own arms held up to the lamplight so that he might accurately depict veins and tendons standing proud from the surface. He referred to a small mirror at times. The surface of the skin he carved was a rich landscape stretched over bone and muscle, creased in corners, drawn smooth as it swept over curves. For the woman's body, his memory of Kalin was vivid enough to require little other reference. He wanted this work to show the capacity for movement, for intent, for accomplishment. The posture of the figures displayed awareness. The expression of the faces, especially the eyes, would show that most sublime human characteristic, thought. If the statues he had seen in the old world were a celebration of misery and death, this was a celebration of life. He wanted this to show the raw power of volition. The man and woman he carved were his refuge against his despair over his captivity. They embodied freedom of spirit. They embodied reason rising up to triumph. To his great annoyance, Richard noticed that light was coming in the window above the statue, taking over from the lamps that had burned all night. All night! He had done it again. It was not the quality of the light, which he actually very much favored, which vexed him, but that it signified the end of his time with his statue. He now had to go carve ugliness down at the site. Fortunately, that work required no thought or careful effort. As he draw-filed the curve of the man's shoulder muscle, there was a knock at the door.
"Richard!"
It was Victor. Richard sighed. He had to stop. Richard pulled the red cloth tied around his neck down away from his nose and mouth, where it kept him from breathing all the marble dust. It was a little trick Victor had told him about, used by the marble carvers from his homeland of Cavatura. "Be right there." Richard stepped down off the ledge made by the base, where he had carved out the legs at mid-calf. He stretched his back, realizing how much it hurt from hunching over and from lack of sleep. He retrieved the canvas tarp and shook the dust from it. Just before he flung the cover over the statue, he got the full view of the figures. The floor, shelves, and tools were covered in a fine layer of marble dust, but against the black walls, the marble stood out in the glory of light from above. Richard threw the tarp over the incomplete figures and then opened the door.
"You look like a ghost,"
Victor announced with a lopsided grin. Richard brushed himself off. "I forgot the time."
"Did you see in the shop last night?"
"The shop? No, what?" Victor's grin returned, wider this time.
"Briska had the bronze dial delivered yesterday. Ishak brought it. Come see."
Around the other side of the blacksmith's shop, in the stockroom, the bronze sat in a number of pieces. It was too big for Briska to cast as one piece, so he had made several that Victor would join and mount. The pedestal for the partial ring that would be the dial plane was massive. Knowing it was for a statue Richard was carving, Briska had done a job to be proud of.
"It's beautiful,"
Richard said.
"Isn't it, though? I've seen him do fine work before, but this time Briska has outdone himself."
Victor squatted and ran his fingers over the strange symbols filled in with black.
"Briska said that at one time, long ago, his home city of Altur-Rang had freedom, but like so many others, lost it. As a tribute to that time, he cast it with symbols in his native tongue. Brother Neil saw it and was pleased because he thought it a tribute to the Emperor, who is also from Altur-Rang."
Richard sighed. "Briska has a tongue as smooth as his castings."
"Would you have some lardo with me?"
Victor asked as he stood. The sun was already well up. Richard stretched his neck and peered down at the site. "I'd best not. I need to get to work." Richard squatted down and lifted one end of the pedestal. "First, though, let me show you where this goes." Victor grabbed the other end, and together they lugged the bronze casting around the shop. When Richard opened the double doors, Victor saw the statue for the first time, even if it was covered in a tarp that revealed only the round bulges that were the two heads. Even so, Victor's eyes feasted. It was apparent in those eyes how his vivid imagination was filling in some of it with his fondest hopes.
"Your statue is going well?"
Victor nudged Richard with an elbow.
"Beauty?"
Richard was overcome with a blissful smile. "Ah, Victor, you will see for yourself soon enough. The dedication is only a couple of weeks off. I will be ready. It will be something to bring a song to our hearts. Before they kill me, anyway." Victor dismissed such talk with a flourish of his hand.
"I am hoping that when they see such beauty again, and at their palace, they will approve."
Richard held out no such illusion. He remembered then and reached into a pocket to pull out a piece of paper. He handed it to the blacksmith. "I didn't want Briska to cast words on the back of the dial because I didn't want the wrong people to see them. I would ask you to engrave these words on the back surface, about the same height as the symbols on the front. Victor took the paper and unfolded it. His grin melted away. He looked up at Richard with an open look of surprise.
"This is treason,"
Richard shrugged. "They can only kill me once."
"They can torture you a long time before they kill you. They have very unpleasant ways to kill people, too, Richard. Have you ever seen a man buried in the sky while he was still alive, bleeding from a thousand cuts, his arms bound, so that the vultures could feast on his living flesh?"
"The order binds my arms now, Victor. As I work down there, as I see the death around me, I am bleeding from a thousand cuts. The vultures of the order are already feasting on my flesh." With grim resolve, Richard held Victor's gaze. "Will you do it?" Victor glanced down at the paper again. He took a deep breath, and then let it slowly out as he studied the paper in his hand.
"Treason though these words be, I like them. I will do it."
Richard clapped him on the side of the shoulder and gave him a confident smile. "Good man. Now, look here, where the pedestal is to be attached." Richard lifted the tarp enough to uncover the base. "I've carved you a flat face tilted at the proper angle. I didn't know where the holes in the casting would be, so I left it for you to drill the holes and fill them with lead for the pins. Once you attach the pedestal, then I can calculate the angle of the hole I'll need to drill for the gnomon." Victor nodded.
"The gnomon pole will be ready soon. I will make you a drill bit the proper size for it."
"Good. And a round rasp to do final fitting in the hole?"
"You will have it,"
Victor said as they both stood. He waved his hand toward the covered statue.
"You trust me not to peek while you are off carving your ugly work?"
Richard chuckled. "Victor, I know you want more than anything to see the nobility of this statue when it is finally finished. You would not spoil that experience for yourself for anything." Victor let out his rolling belly laugh.
"I guess you are right. Come after your work, and we will have lardo and talk of beauty in stone and the way the world once was."
Richard hardly heard Victor. He was staring at what he knew so well. Even though it was covered from his eyes, it was not hidden from his soul. He was ready to begin the process of polishing to make flesh in stone. Her head bent, her scarf protecting her from the chill wind, Nikki hurried down the narrow alleyway. A man coming the other way bumped against her shoulder, not because he was rushing, but because he simply didn't seem to care where he was going. Nikki threw a fiery scowl at his empty eyes. Her fierce look fell away down a bottomless well of indifference. She clutched her sack of sunflower seeds closer to her stomach as she moved on through the muddy alleyway. She stayed close to the rough wooden walls of the building so she wouldn't be jostled by the people going the other way. People bundled against the current cold snap moved through the alleyway toward the street beyond, looking for rooms, for food, for clothes, for jobs. She could see men beyond the alley sitting on the ground, leaning against buildings on the far side of the street, watching without seeing as wagons rumbled down the roads, taking supplies out to the site of the Emperor's palace. Nikki wanted to get to the bread shop. She had been told they might have butter today. She wanted to get butter for Richard's bread. He would be home for dinner. He had promised. She wanted to make him a good meal. He needed to eat. He had lost some weight, though it only added distracting definition to his muscular build. He was like a statue in the flesh, like the statues she used to see long ago. She remembered how, when she was little, her mother's servants made cakes out of sunflower meal. She had been able to buy enough to make him some sunflower cakes, and maybe she would have butter to put on them. Nikki was growing increasingly anxious. The dedication was to take place in a few days. Richard said his statue would be ready. He seemed too calm about it, as if he had come to some inner peace. He seemed almost like a man who had accepted his imminent execution. Whenever Richard spoke to her, despite the conversation, his mind seemed elsewhere, and his eyes held that quality which she so valued. In the wasteland that was life, the misery that was existence, this was the only hope left to her. All around her, people looked forward only to death. Only in her father's eyes when she was younger, and more so now in Richard's, did she see any evidence that there was something to make it all worthwhile, some reason for existence. Nicky was slowed to a halt by the clink, clink, clink of pebbles rattling in a cup. The sound was the unmistakable rattle of her chains. She had been a servant to need her whole life, and as much as she tried, there it was, the cup of some poor beggar, still rattling for her help. She could not deny it. Tears filled her eyes. She had so wanted to serve Richard butter with his bread, but she had only one silver penny, and this beggar had nothing. She had at least some bread and some sunflower seeds. How could she want butter for Richard's bread and cakes when this man had nothing? She was evil, she knew, for wanting to keep her silver penny, the penny Richard had earned with his own sweat and effort. She was evil for wanting to buy butter for Richard with it. Who was Richard to have butter? He was strong. He was able. Why should he have more while others had none? Nicky could almost see her mother slowly shaking her head in bitter disappointment that the penny was still in Nicky's fist and not helping the man in need. How was it that she could never seem to live up to her mother's example of morality? How was it she could never overcome her evil nature? Nicky turned slowly and dropped her silver penny in the beggar's cup. People gave the beggar a wide berth. Without seeing him, they avoided coming near him. They were deaf to the rattle of his cup. How could people not yet have learned the order's teachings? How could they not help those in need? It was always left to her. She looked at him then, and recoiled at the sight of the hideous man swathed in filthy rags. She pulled back more when she saw lice hopping through his thatch of greasy hair. He peered out at her through a slit in the rags draped around his face. But it was what she saw through that slit that caught her breath in her throat. The scars were gruesome, to be sure, as if he had been melted by the keeper's own fires. Yet it was the eyes that gripped her as the man slowly rose to his feet. The man's grimy fingers, like a claw, curled around her arm. "Nicky," he hissed in startled triumph, drawing her close. Caught in the grip of his powerful fingers and his burning glare, she was unable to move. She was so close she could see his lice hopping at her.
"Kadar Kardif."
"So... you recognize me, even like this?"
This is the end of this cassette. This program is continued on side one of cassette number 19.